You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Yeah, I think the general drift of the Bible portrays God as powerful. And it's funny sometimes when, you know, like I'll post the title of my book on social media, someone will retort by quoting some passage, usually from the Old Testament, that talks about, you know, great is the Lord and mighty in power. And as if that's some sort of a undermining of my claims in the book. Which, of course, it's not. I do think God is mighty. I just think that we've not been very careful in trying to describe God's power in light of God's love, in light of creaturely freedom, in light of logical contradictions, in light of ontological contradictions, in light of a whole host of factors. And therefore, many Christians have a God, at least the way they talk about God, who is actually too big to make any sense. They describe God in ways that are so outlandishly large that they can't then make sense of what we've already mentioned, like free will. And so that's part of what I'm doing in this book, is giving us, we might say, a right-sized view of God's power.
If God has a face, his face must look like yours.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we are back with a new guest. Well, old guest, but returning guest. Yeah, there you go. Dr. Thomas J. Ord. And for those of you who have been listening for a while, you probably remember him coming on in support of a couple of his prior books, including God Can't. Kind of stirred some stuff up, which is kind of fun to do every once in a while. But it's one of those topics, the topic of like, why do bad things happen to good people? And, you know, why is there pain and suffering in the world? And why doesn't God intervene? It's one of those questions that a lot of folks ask, and especially a lot of folks who have abandoned religion altogether, because, you know, how do you reconcile that? You know, one hand, we're talking about an all-powerful, all-loving God who can do anything. And yet, you know, we continue to see things like school shootings and you know, forest fires that take out entire, you know, neighborhoods, and all sorts of awful violence, wars, and, you know, like the one happening in Ukraine. And yet, you know, it doesn't seem as if God intervenes. And so what does that mean, and how do we reason with that? And so he's taken a stab at it in a couple of his books prior, and he's got a new one that just came out that is kind of builds on that work, called The Death of Omnipotence and Birth of Amipotence. Oh my gosh. And he had to write a book using creating a term that is incredibly difficult for me to pronounce. And I think I nailed it one time in this entire interview. Amipotence. There we go. Yes, I got it. I did it. But it's a really interesting, it's a really interesting theory that he puts forth. And it was a really fun conversation to have, you know, in regards to, you know, someone who's willing to take a stab at that particular, you know, conundrum that we've been dealing with for thousands of years. So really, really fun conversation. So this one's a one-parter, a little bit shorter, but you know, hopefully you guys enjoy it. Before we get into it, though, the usual housekeeping stuff. If you get to our website, it's been active, very, very active recently, as has our Patreon account that you can link to from our website, www.thedeconstructionist.com. That's plural. If you go there, new blog posts, obviously all the episodes from all the way back to the beginning, you can stream directly from the website. You can link to our web store, our Patreon, if you want to support us there. I put all of the episodes out a week early, unedited, uncut, for any Patreon supporters at $5 or above. So if you want an early copy, whatever you want to call it, if you want to stream it early, you can do so in its full form, the entire interview, as opposed to in two parts. So you can get that there. There's a bunch of other packages, and we have international shipping for some of the merch there now as well. So check it out. Otherwise, you know, we've got, like I said, new blog posts going up and some more coming, and we'll put some old school photos up there too if you want to see some behind the scenes stuff. So all that you can find there on the website. So with that, I want to thank Forrest Clay, our friend Clay Kirchenbauer, for providing the music on this week's episode, and our sponsor, HelloFresh. You just heard the commercial, but as I always say, I try to back sponsors that are products that I would or have used, and this is one that I've been using for years, actually, and as a single dad, saves me a ton of time. I totally believe in it. Their meals are delicious, and my daughter and I just got our package today, and we'll do our usual tradition where she'll open the box, and she'll decide which one she wants for dinner, and then that's the one we'll make. So, but you get free meals, 16 free meals and free shipping. If you use the Deconstruct16 discount code at the website, all the details are in the show notes. Check it out. Otherwise, let's get to it. And I can't do the freaking because he's a three-parter. So without further ado, I give you Thomas J. Ord.
It looks like us. Does God.
All right. Welcome back to the podcast. I have a returning guest, Thomas J. Ord. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, John.
Yeah, I feel like I've joked before with some of my other returning guests that I need to start offering like those five timers jackets that they have on SNL.
Yeah.
it's a very special but small club. So no, I appreciate you coming back on. And we were just talking before we started recording, your new book, really is just, you always do such a great job of your next book really kind of building off the prior, and there's a nice thread throughout. So this is really a natural progression of God Can't and your follow-up on that. So appreciate you coming on to talk about it.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity. I wanted to write a book that I thought, well, we'll get into the discussion, I'm sure, but there's some new things in this book, and then I say some things I've said in the past, but I say it in a different way.
Yeah, you take a slightly different approach. So I'll say the book is called The Death of Omnipotence and Birth of I knew I was going to stumble over that. Go ahead and say it for me.
The Birth of Omnipotence.
Yes, so... like I said, it really builds on your prior work. So what kind of inspired you to sort of dive into this aspect of sort of your ideas that you've kind of put out there?
Yeah. Well, this particular book has four chapters, and I think of it kind of like four movements in a concerto or something. And three of the chapters are really pretty novel set of ideas. One chapter, when I address the problem of evil, it's kind of addressing some of the themes that I have in previous books, but I wanted to come at it from a different angle. So, just a quick overview. The first chapter is arguing that omnipotence isn't in the Bible. The second chapter is arguing that philosophically, the word omnipotence has to be qualified so often that it dies a death of 1,000 qualifications. Third chapter is addressing the problem of evil, and I make the argument that evil ends, or at least should end, the idea that God is omnipotent. And then the last chapter, people read my book God Can't and some other books, and they kind of got the impression that God can't do anything. And they thought they had to choose between an omnipotent God or an impotent God. And that last chapter is my constructive alternative with regard to God's power.
Yeah, I think starting off with the first chapter, I think before we really dig into the book here, start by defining for folks, like, what do we mean, generally speaking, when we say omnipotent? Because that is pretty a common theme throughout, you know, at least American Christianity. You know, it's in worship songs, you know, we sing hymns about it, we talk about it in Bible school. It seems like it's just this, you know, thing that's just always been there. But, you know, what do we mean by that?
Yeah, and that's actually an interesting question in itself, because there's oftentimes not a clear definition of omnipotence provided by whatever author is using the word. So at the outset, I say when I'm using the word omnipotent, I'm referring to at least one of what I think are the three most common or dominant meanings of omnipotence that you would find not only amongst people on the street, but also amongst the major theologians and philosophers in history. One view of omnipotence is that God literally exerts all the power, so God does absolutely everything that gets done. Sometimes that's called divine determinism. And you find some, for instance, versions of Calvinism who have that view of God's power. Second view of God's power says God can do absolutely anything. Nothing is impossible for God. Now, some of these people will say, even though God can do anything, God voluntarily chooses not to do some things. But they think that God inherently or essentially has the power to do anything imaginable. And the third way to talk about omnipotence is to say that God has the power to control creatures or creation, if by control we mean something like God alone can bring about whatever outcomes or results that God wants. So those three meanings of omnipotence are what I address in this book, and I reject all three of them.
Yeah, so start by, you talk about the fact that you first kind of dive in the fact that omnipotence, you know, where do we, when we talk about that word, immediately we assume that it's found somewhere in the Bible. And so you talk about perhaps some of the issues with that. So talk about, like, you have three words that you specifically refer to in references to divine power. So talk about those a little bit.
Yeah, most English-speaking people, if they pick up one of the translations of the scriptures, we'll call them the Christian scriptures, they'll read in the Old Testament or Hebrew scriptures or the New Testament, they'll occasionally come across the word Almighty in English. And so what I do is I begin with the Old Testament, and I look at those instances in which that word Almighty shows up in English translations and ask, okay, what is the word in Hebrew being referred to here? And there are two words that are at play. One is the word Shaddai. Many people may have heard of the phrase El Shaddai. And the other is Sabaoth. Shaddai, according to the vast majority of biblical scholars, means something like breasts. So to say El Shaddai would be the God of breasts. Or it's very close to mountains as well, the Hebrew word sadu. So breasts or mountains, a source of nourishment or a source of protection. And then the second word, Sabaoth, means something like hosts or armies or a group or a council. And when it's preceded by one of the words that in English we typically translate as God, like Adonai or Elohim or something like that, it means Lord of hosts or Lord of the armies or leader of the council. But around about the second and third century BCE, a bunch of Greeks wanted to translate the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. And when they got to those two words, they chose the single Greek word pantokrator. Panto meaning all, krater meaning something like holding or sustaining. And so that word, pantokrator, in the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew scriptures, it shows up 10 times in the Christian New Testament. 9 of those in Revelation and 1 the Apostle Paul uses Pantocrator when he's quoting the Septuagint, actually. But the real move comes in about the 6th century when a guy named Jerome is translating the scriptures into Latin, what's usually called the Latin Vulgate. And he looks at that word Pantocrator from the Septuagint in the New Testament, and he translates it as omnipotens or omnipotence. And so in the major creeds like Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, when it says we believe in the God, the Father Almighty, that word Almighty was originally omnipotent. And that's where we get that word.
That's really interesting. And so you kind of dig in from there to some of the issues that we have with ascribing omnipotence to God. You know, for example, like if God is truly in control of all things, then why does, you know, bad things happen to good people? And I know you kind of talk about that in your prior works, but also it sort of clashes against this idea of free will. Because on one hand, we say God can do all things, but on the other hand, we also say, well, we have free will. You know, we have the leeway to make mistakes and to go against God's will, but the two can't really go hand in hand. I mean, it sort of
no
conflicts. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think some people start off with by saying, okay, I think God has the most power imaginable. And, you know, sometimes a philosopher might use the word maximal power or almighty or sovereignty or all power. And then they, at least some people want to say, but it seems like creatures also have some power, including free will, self-causation. And so what some folks want to do is they don't want to give up on the notion that God is controlling and has all the power. And they also think, well, but I can't deny my own experience that I'm free. So they choose a position in philosophy that's called compatibilism, that in some mysterious, unknown way, God is both in control and we have free will. That view, I think, is less and less common in academic circles and like amongst, let's say, Christian philosophers. Most of them want to affirm what's in philosophy called libertarian free will, but it's still there in some places. And it's even there in some philosophers who don't believe in God, but who think that, you know, the neurons or the atoms or the quarks in some way control all things. And free will is really an illusion, but they want to say we have free will.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Yeah, I was going to say, so carrying on with that idea, like the Bible does, in fact, and you point this out in some of your prior books as well, and God can't, the Bible does, in fact, list some of the things that God can't do. It, I mean, it straight up says it in Scripture that there are certain things that God inherently cannot do. So talk about that a little.
Yeah, and that surprises a lot of people when I bring it up. You know, God can't tell a lie, for instance, according to Titus in Hebrews. God can't be tempted, says James. God can't grow tired, says the psalmist. God can't abandon us, says Hosea. My favorite passage or statement that I think kind of is an overarching claim is that God cannot deny himself, which is a way of saying there are things that God can't do because to do them, God simply wouldn't be God. And in this book, I list those kinds of things in my discussion about God not being able to go against the divine nature. So things like God can't decide to stop existing. God can't be both omnipresent and missing from Miami. God can't be omniscient and yet not know something. And so these are kinds of things that are limitations on what God can do based upon who God is, not based upon some external force or something like that, but just on the divine nature.
Yeah, it's, what's interesting is sort of one of the takeaways I had from the book is that you know, God can be mighty without being omnipotent, and that's it, we seem to kind of feel as if it has to be one or the other. As you said at the top, like to be omnipotent has to be, you know, you're either omnipotent or completely, you know, without power. It has to be one or the other. When God can be mighty without having control over everything, and it sort of led me to the thought that it seems like omnipotence, or the idea or the need for God to be omniscient, seems to have to do more with control versus God's ability to act in the world.
Yeah, I think that's fair, at least in a lot of cases. Yeah, I think the general drift of the Bible portrays God as powerful. And it's funny sometimes when, you know, like I'll post the title of my book on social media, someone will retort by quoting some passage, usually from the Old Testament, that talks about, you know, great is the Lord and mighty in power, and as if that's some sort of a undermining of my claims in the book, which of course it's not. I do think God is mighty. I just think that we've not been very careful in trying to describe God's power in light of God's love, in light of creaturely freedom, in light of logical contradictions, in light of ontological contradictions, in light of a whole host of factors. And therefore, many Christians have a God, at least the way they talk about God, who is actually too big to make any sense. They describe God in ways that are so outlandishly large that they can't then make sense of what we've already mentioned, like free will. And so that's part of what I'm doing in this book, is giving us, we might say, a right-sized view of God's power.
Yeah, so in your second chapter, you really, that's where I feel like you really expand on your work in God Can't, stemming from the, you know, as you sort of already alluded to, this philosophical paradox. You know, I think the funny one that you point out is, you know, can God create a rock that's so big that not even God can lift it, you know? And so I thought that was really interesting. And again, you, as you said, you kind of come at it from a different angle, though, and kind of re-exploring some of the, you know, some of the material that you've covered before.
Yeah. And, you know, in this chapter, if you're a professional philosopher, you're going to start reading this chapter, and the first two thirds of it, you're going to say to yourself, oh yeah, we've kind of already thought that. But 99% of the rest of the people who believe in God haven't been thinking about these things. They haven't been considering the possibility that God can't make a round square, or can't make 2 plus 2 equal 378, or can't decide to, you know, to stop existing, like I mentioned earlier, or that God can't both create free moral agents and guarantee that those moral agents will always choose the good. And so all kinds of issues that the average person really doesn't think a lot about, a lot of Christian philosophers have thought about him. But I sort of start listing them out, and I think I have about 50 examples in the chapter. Near the end, I get to some things that God can't do that I think will surprise even professional Christian philosophers. And one of them is my expansion on the very common view that God is a universal spirit without a localized divine body. And that means if God's a spirit without a body, God actually doesn't have divine hands with which to pick up pebbles or do push-ups. God doesn't actually have divine teeth to chew bubble gum. God doesn't actually have a divine toe to kick a soccer ball. And so you and I can do a lot of those things because we're embodied creatures. So if we start thinking carefully about these typical views of God and think about their implications, it should make us rethink how we talk about God's power, and that in turn can help us deal with the biggest objections to belief in God, which one of them is the problem of evil.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get into that because I think that's one of the most important parts of the book. Before we do that, though, I think one of the pieces that you kind of just mentioned was one of my favorite parts of your prior work is just this notion that that God through Spirit continues to create, but does so in conjunction with God's own creation, meaning that God works alongside human beings to combat evil and to bring good about in the world.
Yeah, that's crucial for my argument because I don't think God ever single-handedly brings about results. And yet I'm claiming God is mighty and powerful. In fact, the most powerful. Then I've got to have some sort of account for how God can be so powerful and yet be unable to pick up a pebble like you and I can. And the way that I do that is talking about God's omnipresence. So God is everywhere in the universe. And God's action is in part calling and empowering creatures to then respond. And so when creatures respond well to God's nudging, God's urgings, God's calling, then we can say that God's power is effective in ways that are dependent upon creature response. And if God's omnipresent, if God's been acting this way everlastingly, then it's not that hard to see how God can be the mightiest of all.
Yeah, I love that. As I said, that was one of my favorite parts of your prior books as well. Yeah.
Well, yeah, part of the implications is that you and my lives matter. Like, you know, this conversation for this podcast, it actually makes a difference in God's work in the world. I happen to think that God is calling you and I to have this conversation at this time. And so as we respond properly to God's activity, then we are co-creating with God this particular experience in this podcast. And I think that makes a real difference to not only the creation, but to God.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love that. So we definitely got to get into this part, though. You already kind of mentioned this, but I just marked down my note was the problem of evil and omnipotence. So talk about that, because I think that is one of the most crucial chapters or sections of the book.
Yeah. The number one reason, at least according to the polls I've seen, that atheists give for why they can't believe there is a God is what philosophers call the problem of evil. And that problem is that if there's a God who's omnipotent and perfectly loving, then why is there genuine evil in the world? And by genuine evil, I mean events that make the world worse than it otherwise might have been. Wouldn't a loving God prevent the evil that's preventable? And most theists, including professional theologians and philosophers, they don't have a really good answer to this question because they continue to cling to that classic view of omnipotence. And what I do in one of the chapters, after showing how there's all kinds of problems for this, for politics and religious experience and all kinds of other issues, I get around to saying, if we take away omnipotence, then we can say that God is working with creation, is powerful, is trying to heal, is trying to squeeze something good out of the bad God didn't want in the first place. We can have a really active God, but this God would be uncontrolling and therefore not morally responsible, not culpable for failing to prevent evil.
Yeah, and the important thing that I love about that is also that you keep coming back to the central theme of love. Like God, yeah. God ultimately is the source of love, and you know that's the central action in all things.
Yeah, that's at the heart of my theology. It's the way I try to live my life. I wouldn't believe in God if I didn't think God was first and foremost loving. I wouldn't try to live a life of love if I thought there was no, God empowering and inspiring me to be loving in loving ways. So, I don't know if we talked about this last time we chatted, but there was a time in my life when I did not believe in God. I was an atheist, and it was the issues of love that brought me to think it was more plausible than not that there's a God. And so those function in my constructive theological work. Those ideas of love function as the center of my thinking.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a place where I kind of eventually landed as well. When we talk about this idea that we are made in God's image, you know, as a kid in my childlike brain, I kept thinking, well, God looks like a human being, you know,
and yeah.
As I got older, I thought I've shifted more towards, you know, if God is the source of endless love, you know, then really what that means to me is that each of us are born with that love spark within us. And so when we freely give that love away, you know, in the sense that it's no strings attached, that it's just purely for the sake of extending that love, that's where we see a glimpse of God or the divine, here on earth. You know, it's kind of bringing us closer to the source in a way.
Yeah. When we're done with this, let me send you, I wrote a chapter in a book on Imago Dei, the image of God, in which I make that kind of argument that relational love is the best way to think about the Imago Dei.
Yeah, I love that. I would love to read that. So you talk about, I thought this was kind of funny because Adam, my partner who I started this with years ago, and I used to tongue in cheek kind of lovingly make fun of worship music a lot. Like, cause it's always so positive. And we're like, where's the lament music, you know, like the stuff of real life, you know? And
yeah.
So you mentioned the fact in the book that a lot of modern worship music is just chock full of references to power and kings and, you know, these figures of power, you know, and you know, in my mind, I kept running back through like songs that I knew that were popular. It's all has a lot of similar phrasing in it. So,
yeah.
So we really kind of like, we kind of really put that out there into the universe. You know, everybody, you know, when you think of a worship song, most of them, you probably think of, you know, it has this positive message, happy ending, and God is all powerful and the King of Kings.